Welcome to Influential Visions. Here, we interview futuristic leaders who share their deep industry knowledge and business experience with you, ensuring you have your finger on the pulse and your eyes wide open. My name is Nathaniel Schooler, and I am your host today. Well, hello, everyone. I am joined by Jude Pullen today, and he's a technologist and actually a physical prototyping expert. And I'm quite interested to talk to you. I know you've worked on micro projects with the BBC to help with all sorts of different things. And you've also worked with Dyson and Lego and loads of the big brands on like huge projects, right? So welcome.
Hello there. Great to be here. Thanks a lot, Matt.
We're going to have fun today. I'm wearing my fun t-shirt. But look. There we go. Woo-hoo. So, obviously, you know, we've got this big change that's been happening, right? But we still need innovation. We need innovation now more than ever before, right? So we're going to, I think, firstly talk about creating innovation that has value in the changing world. And I know you've been creating all sorts of crazy things, right, over the past few years, but practical things, right?
Mm.
So, I mean, I know before we started recording, we were sort of talking a bit about 3D printing, the revolution around that. And I'm really interested in that. So maybe we talk a bit about that to start with.
Well, yeah, I guess I should sort of confess that I'm a little bit bought into the camp in that I'm sitting only an arm's length away from a 3D printer. But I think it's almost worth framing that in that I got that back maybe almost about 8 years ago, and I won it in a competition on a website called Instructables. And it was because I made this little thing called a solder buddy, which was a little thing that fed solder wire through this little series of motors. But the point is, I can't put my hand up and say I was such an early adopter and that I knew the power of 3D printing. I was also at the point where that machine at the time was worth $1,500. And yeah. So it was quite intimidating as someone who was only in their early 20s to think, I'm just going to drop that sort of money as an investment on my future. Yeah. But it's one of those things, like, you know, the film The Graduate, where he's leaning over to the sun and he's like, the future is plastics, my boy. I kind of feel there's a little bit of that element of that the future isn't the 3D printing. The future is the 3D printing mindset. That's actually more powerful than the thing itself.
Got you. So that's more of a localized manufacturing thing. Is that fair to say?
So localized, I often refer to it, I guess I think I'm stealing a phrase from a completely incorrect industry, but run with me. But the last mile is what I sort of use it for. Is that, for example, I was working with a chap called Nigel Ackland, and he's basically got a prosthetic from the NHS. Now, it does an incredible job to a point. And then as soon as you get into tailoring it specifically to the weird eccentricities and needs that make him who he is, called individuality, you suddenly find yourself in that last mile where the NHS just cannot afford to do those bells and whistles. But those bells and whistles make all the difference.
Right.
You know, it's like, it's the reason you're wearing a t-shirt that isn't just a plain black t-shirt to keep you warm and not, you know, UV, you wanted something extra, right?
Yeah.
And I think people often forget that, well, someone with a disability or an impairment is exactly the same. They yeah. want that little embellishment because it's the silver lining that makes all the difference to them.
Right. But it's not just that, isn't it? When you say the last mile, it could be anything. I see a world like you. We think about the future a lot. We're deep thinkers, right? And I see the world whereby, you know, you might order something from IKEA or whatever, but everything that you can print yourself, yeah, there'll be one button which says I've got a 3D printer, one button that says I don't have one. And if you don't have one, you get one box, yeah, which will be more expensive, yeah, obviously. Mm-hmm. And they'll charge you for the labor, for the 3D printing, for this, for that. But then you've got your other box, which will basically come in a small box. You get all the bits and pieces that you can't make yourself because you can't 3D print wood, yeah. And whatever, yep. Right? But if it's clay, or if it's obviously when clay printers get a bit better, right, 3D printing and get more available, right? But you'll be able to print all the stuff yourself, and you can choose how strong you want it to be. you know. So I get it, right? My buddy, he's got loads of 3D printers. He made me this hand, which the finger fell off. To anyone not watching this, I've got a 3D. I love this one because it freaks people out, because you pick it up and you show them the 3D middle finger, which is on a golden hand. Yeah, but unfortunately, I dropped it on the floor and it fell off. So you're going to give me some kind advice on what adhesives to use, I think.
Well, I mean, that probably comes from working not just in prototyping, but I also worked in a startup called Sugru, which was a sort of moldable glue. So if you imagine plasticine mixed with super glue, metaphorically speaking, wasn't actually what was in the formula, but it has that sort of properties. So, I never planned to get into that, but that's almost been the trademark of my career, is I tend to sort of jump if it excites me and then try and retrospectively explain to people why it was such a great decision to go there.
That sounds familiar, actually. Sounds really familiar.
I think it
does
to probably most of your listeners is exactly that trait, yeah.
So what excites you then about this, about the 3D printing and actually the changing world that is happening right now and the innovations that people can make? Because I know, like, you can actually go online and you can, if you've got a 3D printer, and you can find catalogs and catalogs of stuff you can just pull out in a file. You take the file and I forget what the site's called, but my friend showed me and we created, like,
Thingiverse or whatever. Yeah.
Whatever it is. And it's like a library, right, of all of these items. Yeah. So what excites you about that kind of thing?
So if I'm completely honest, and this is just, you know, this isn't to say that I'm trying to pour cold water on your enthusiasm, but in many ways, because I've been trained as a designer, I find often what I use a 3D printer for is very work orientated. So the stuff, like, I actually love that people are making those, you know, that, you know, those little hearts that you spin around the gears and it morphs into different things and then comes back to the others. So there's all these sorts of crazy little Rubik's-y cube, Archimedes cradle type things, mm-hmm, that exist in the 3D printed world, because they'd be impossible to make in anything but a 3D printer. I think those are actually, people can be quite snarky and say, oh, but they're trivial, they're not doing anything to society. And I think often, you know, this is something I definitely felt was sort of had the backing of Lego in my head, is that people underestimate the importance of play.
Yes.
In that it usually is a precursor, and I'd say play, art, and also silliness or fun to your t-shirt often have to come before we truly understand the potential of something.
Yeah.
And I think I'm quite sure that, you know, children are probably playing little games with stones back in the sort of Neolithic days before they figured out how to make a slingshot. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It will have escalated from the play to sort of throw it at someone's head and be like, ow. And then, you know, later to realize we could take down a mammoth. So I still see the sort of the Yodas and the sort of whimsical stuff as that's in the play phase. And you see this in virtual reality, you see this in augmented reality. You know, there's a reason you could say, oh, it's not there yet. And you go, it isn't. But if you haven't got any chips as a VC resting on some of those bets, you just don't know which of those is going to go from the play phase to being something quite extraordinarily valuable to society.
Yeah. I mean, I've been doing Tai Chi, right, nearly 25 years. Yeah. So, like, every day I'll do between half an hour to 3 hours training, right, strengthening my body. Yeah. And I thought about this idea, you know, well, perhaps, you know, I could teach people Tai Chi online, and there are people learning Tai Chi online, right? But I tell you what, when I read the comments from these Facebook Live videos that they're doing to get clients, yeah, I read these comments. It's like, oh, my knee hurts, yeah, and it's like, well, actually, your knee hurts because you're not in the right position, yeah. So if you could cover that body with sensors, motion sensors, and weight sensors, and know where the person was actually leaning, you could tell that their weight wasn't on their feet in the right place and their knee alignment wasn't correct and blah, blah, blah. Yeah. So in your mind now, you've got a vision of, like, all these sensors probably of what needs to happen in the body. Because you could create that, right? I don't personally want to do it, but I know people who might want to do that, right? So it's like, what do you do to start with? you're right, have fun, right? You have fun with it, yeah? And like my buddy Eric, he makes all these things for his aeroplane, yeah? He made like an extra foot pedal for his aeroplane, yeah? He's got a little, a few aeroplanes, a few little small two-seater aeroplanes, right? But he does all the mechanics and stuff himself, right? And then there are going to be other people that can't do that. And I think that's where obviously you come in and you help them to create whatever prototype they need, yeah? Because it takes time to like understand how these things work. If you're not minded in that way, it's difficult to plan it out, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's that thing. How do we understand the potential of something, I guess, is what we're discussing. And I guess it's interesting when you look at things like, you know, let's take the arthritis, sorry, the Tai Chi example. I guess there's two ways I'd almost sort of go about looking at that. In that, one, I would probably go Tai Chi, you know, and I say this with my wife and my mother-in-law doing this to a very high level. So I don't say this just sort of glibly, but I think it does actually require quite a lot of maturity, I think, as a sweeping generalization. It tends to be 12-year-olds don't gravitate towards Tai Chi.
True.
I think that's a fair generalization.
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of felt if I wanted to grow that market, I probably would almost develop the technology somewhere that would basically prove it out quicker. So let's say that it was with, you know, let's just use an example where there's probably buckets of money doing, you know, just being thrown at things. But let's say TikTok said, actually, we're going to put a gait analysis tool so that when people are dancing and doing all these silly things, we're doing machine learning on it to understand that. Yeah. And then it means by the time you come round to what, let's face it, is a smaller size demographic, a smaller total addressable market of Tai Chi,
mm-hmm.
is that you might have trained half of the necessary technology so that then you go that final, as it were, final mile specifically for that industry. I think you see this so much with sort of big tech, in that a lot of the times people will think, oh wow, you know, my phone's got all this ability to play games when I tilt it. And I often remind people and say, yeah, that's an accelerometer. That probably started out life as a chip to fly a missile. And the reason it's cheap enough to be in your phone at almost no cost is because it was already developed for scale by a completely different industry that you're unaware of. So I appreciate you know this, but I just hope it's useful for some of the listeners that often the big disruptive thing is sometimes also coming from a different category, a different department, a different technology. And just applying it somewhere else where it's novel rather than inventing the wheel, as it
were. Of course, because there are so many libraries of open source things. Like if you think about the protocol for video conference calling, yeah? Like it's open source, yeah? You can just pick it up and you can put it in and then you build it and you adapt, don't you? You adapt out, right? Like my sister actually works at Intel, so she was one of the people that actually did the protocol behind the video conference calling that we use, that everybody uses. There wouldn't be video conference calling without that team at Intel, apparently. Mm. She was going to pick up an award in June this year, but unfortunately, I don't think that will happen yet physically. She was going to go to Ireland and pick it up because she's based over in Silicon Valley, right? So, you know, but I'm absolutely amazed at the changes that are going to need to happen to enable us to be more clean, yeah, and to distance, you know, and to monitor. I mean, there are so many things that we could talk about right now, and there are so many innovations, yeah. Like my brain is just ticking really quickly now, thinking, because I just drank a load of really strong coffee, right? That probably didn't help. but it's like, if you think, like, you know, 10 years ago, like I've got an iWatch, right? An iWatch 5, yeah, the latest iWatch. Right? I absolutely love it. I feel like I'm in Star Trek, yeah? But the thing is, I don't use all of the functions, yeah? I probably should dictate more using it and, you know, send messages like this and everything else, but I don't, right? But it's like this sort of technology is mind-blowing. Once you can put a temperature gauge on your iWatch, yeah? Because I know you can get a strap that you can put on the back, which will then sync with an app, yeah? But I don't know. I can't find one. I looked on Amazon. I can't find one, right? I want to buy a temperature gauge, yeah? But it's like then it all goes back to that whole conversation around privacy, which we're not going to have, right?
Okay.
We're not gonna have, because I've had that the past few weeks been doing
with
that
other
loads.
Experts.
Yeah. Because I know you know a lot about that as well, right? But I know you're big into AI as well, and what that can do in medical. Yeah. I know that there's a lot of work going on with reducing amputations up in Manchester, I think it is, with a great chap I'm going to interview in about 2 weeks' time when he's off. He's on for a few weeks now working, but a vascular surgeon, yeah? Yeah. So they're analyzing data to decide on whether you're going to have your leg or your arm chopped off, yeah? So they're actually reducing the amount of amputations dramatically using that data, yeah? So I see a world whereby, you know, you have a skin rash, you take a great picture of it, you upload it to an NHS or whatever application that there is, and then it analyzes the data and says, well, you've got a 98% chance that that is this. We recommend that you order that. Then you push one click, NHS sends you it via Boots, it arrives, you put the cream on, and then your rash disappears. If it doesn't, then you know that you've got another complaint and you have to go to the doctor, right?
Yeah.
So it's super exciting. Are you excited about that as well?
I think this is such an exciting area. And I guess it's, if anything, it's just the, you know, quite often when you look back in history, experiments were done in quite small scale. You know, I mean, this is why you always hear things like, oh, you know, what was the sample size? No one is asking what is the sample size with big data, because the sample size is huge. Or at least I should, you know, I'm sure there's caveats that essentially now the problem isn't the size of the data set. It's the, is it too, you know, homogenous? Is it just white middle-class guys? I mean, we went through this with Dreyfus, with The Measure of Man, where that was all taken from, you know, guys who were in the army. So of course it didn't apply to women and you know, all these other different races and who had all sorts of different physiologies. So I think that we're going through that same phrase. There's a phrase in engineering called burning in, where you're doing something aggressively to understand all the problems of it, and then it starts to smooth out. So, and by implication, that does mean casualties. And of course, any ethically responsible company will try and minimize casualties in that burning in phase. But I do think we're in that phase a lot with AI at the minute. But it's super exciting because the potential to do good is clearly just so vast. I mean, often you hear this phrase, you know, especially in America, of, you know, the robots are coming, you know, usually implying for our jobs. But I kind of feel it really is an exciting partnership, because I question whether some jobs, you know, I mean, I grew up in Cumbria, which had a big mining industry, and you can still visit the mines and you can go down them. I assure you, I'm very happy that I don't have to put my son down that job. So I think there's going to be a continual movement. And of course, it's a complex one to get there. But I feel that with AI, it's so interesting to think how do we embrace the best of it? And how do we sort of create it as a symbiotic thing? I mean, you mentioned medical. I think the important thing is you never give all the power to the computer, but they prepare much more sophisticated, in-depth results, of which humans would be bad at, and then humans sign off on that. Keep using the last mile now, stuck on the loop. but it is that thing of they say, actually, I know the computer thinks it's this, but I spotted an anomaly, and I'm gonna make that call. I think that's where humans are still gonna be invaluable in the process. So I think the doomsday sayers of AI, I think, save that for the sci-fi films, but yeah, I think invariably we do come good. But I acknowledge the burn-in has casualties.
Yeah, I agree. And I think once they eliminate the bias, I mean, that's the biggest thing, isn't it? And that's why, but that's why all these big tech companies are building the open source AI that people can actually use within their environments, right? And yes, they're expensive to use, but like, you get what you pay for. Yeah, like if I was to hire someone like you, right, I'd expect to pay a lot of money because you've got masses of experience. And if I was a corporation wanting to hire you, I'd pay you what you asked me because you're an expert, right? And that leads on to a little conversation we're going to have about you know, innovation within companies or outside. Yeah, because I know, like, you know, I've been an external consultant myself for, like, you know, 10, 11, 12 years. Yeah. And there are people within companies who have expertise, yeah, inside that company. Right. And harmonizing the two is absolutely key, but there's still a lot of resistance in some organizations, because they're like, oh, well, he might cut or she might come in and make me look stupid, or, you know, so is that tough within innovations?
Yeah. I mean, I guess it's always a really tricky thing, because we'd all like to think that when we pick up a book on design practice, be it Double Diamond, be it Agile, be it whatever new wave thing is happening that I don't know about, it of course is one of these things that's written in hindsight. And if you notice, those books are pretty slim on politics. And yet, strangely, I remember, and this is not a book that a lot of people read because it's a bit of a dry old stick, but there's one by Boothroyd and Dewhurst, mm-hmm. which the first thing, and this is, it's all about design for manufacture and assembly, and the book is like an inch and a half thick, but a quarter of an inch of the first bit is talking about how hard it's going to be to influence change in an organization which has every reason to maintain its status quo. And I really think this book is understated, in that it really almost pulls the rug out from under you to just be like, easy now, before you get carried away with your TED Talks, let me break it down for you how you influence these stratas of people in an organization. Because you've got the people who've risen to the top but have lost touch with the coalface.
Yep.
And they don't want to look stupid, but at the same time they have extreme pressure to make the right decision with limited information. And so how do you build empathy with those people? And then of course there's people who are at the vulnerable stage where their job could be made obsolete with this new sweeping wave of improvement. So how do you basically effectively sell change to be beneficial to all those parties? Or indeed, how do you show that there is a future even if something is going to hurt in the short term? And I think it's an incredible provocation for me. And I think I was very lucky that I was encouraged to, I wouldn't say read it page to page, but at least take in the salient points. And I think we'd do well sometimes to, I think, share a few more battle stories of not just when it worked, but when it didn't, and then really get into the sort of, but why? What would you have done differently? Because I feel, to your point, it's this thing of, invariably, I felt the biggest changes I've either been part of or directly able to influence haven't been inventing the wheel and bringing it externally in. It's been finding the capability and the potential of people within an organization and then setting that free. I think, you know, 9 out of 10, it's always been that way around. And I find that, I'm not going to mention anything just, you know, specifically to companies, but certainly, yeah, Lego, Dyson, and even small startups, I've found that to be consistent. The talent is already in the company, but they may be misunderstood, maligned, poor at communicating. And so I think often my job, it's one of those things that I think it's difficult to bill for if you don't know what I do, but it's really a translator. It's someone who helps translate so that the marketing, the sales team, the C-suite get maybe what someone in the basement has been banging on about for 10 years. And I think often that's the thing. And sometimes the opposite, where the person in the basement is busy polishing, excuse my language, but a poo, let's say. And if you had just managed to communicate the business imperative to them, they'd be like, oh, so you need me just to step a little bit to that side, and then it's going to be worth a huge amount to the business.
Got you.
And people are like, God, I've been telling him that for years, or her.
Yeah.
You know, and then suddenly it goes like gangbusters, and it's terrific. Yeah. And I mean, you've converted someone from frustrated basement dwelling expert to one of the best ingredients in the future of the company's success. I actually always feel, as much as I write prototyping expert, really I deal in human emotions, if I'm honest. That's the secret ingredient.
Yeah. I'm nodding. Like you echo everything that I agree with there. 100%. Yeah, completely. Because it's culture. Everything's about culture. And if you go into a business as an external consultant without talking to each individual person that you're going to be working with and have a conversation, say, I know you probably know what to do here, but I'm just here to just encourage people and to find out what the problems are and get under the beating heart of the business, right? I mean, that's in essence what we're doing here. Yeah. It's really funny because it's the same thing that I do in influencer marketing. Yeah. So I find influential people and then I find companies that need them, and then I understand what they both need, and then I help them to do it, right? So it's a similar, it's a very similar, similar thing, obviously in a different way. Yeah. But with different products, but it's the same really. It's very interesting stuff. I'm super interested really. So with these innovations, right, if people are sitting there and they're thinking, oh, I've got this great idea. Yeah. Like what's the process like for that? Like what, if they've got a budget, obviously,
I guess what level are you thinking of? Are you talking about someone who's maybe, you know, it's a bit of a side hustle and it's not necessarily in their expertise and they don't know about design? Or are you saying someone who's, you know, out in Silicon Valley and just looking for how to connect the dots, network it? Raise.
Good question. I mean, I think
because it's very different gearing, right? You know.
Yeah, of course. But I think right now there are going to be a lot of people who have basically just had their jobs taken away from them. Yeah, there are also businesses right now that are having to change. They've got manufacturing lines. They've got businesses that are, you know, in essence, they need to pivot those businesses. Yeah, and change what they're doing. So you've got these almost two different types of people, yeah, and businesses, right? So first thing is the people who have got some money in the bank, they want to start a business, they want to do it, yeah? Obviously there's a different price for that, for, you know, compared to the people who are in a business who need some help in pivoting that business and creating some new ideas, because there are manufacturing lines that aren't working right now. Okay, sure, that they've made some hand sanitizer and they've made some masks for the NHS, and which, you know, at the moment still aren't there, right? However, there will be manufacturing lines that are different in many ways, so they obviously going to need to fill that that overhead, right? What sort of products and processes, you know, how's it going to work for them if they come to you and
gosh, I mean, again, it's one of those things which I'd caveat always by saying it's a bit case by case. And also, dare I say it, if history has, you know, had any consistent pattern for me, it's that been quite often I'm okay at doing the sort of philosophical what if, but often I find that
if I insulted I'm really sorry, man.
It wasn't a Freudian slip. The insight, rather, the insight definitely is just sometimes you spend time with those people. Admittedly, it might need to be remotely, but either way, just soaking up those little small cues. And I think essentially all I'm really trying to say is that a lot of what my job is trying to understand the things that, you know, maybe to give a bit of a tangible example at Dyson, which I think I'm not telling anything that's particularly controversial or confidential here. But when you look at Dyson, it is a business that it does innovate, it does do disruptive things, but it also plays to its strengths. And I think that would be my advice to anyone who's, let's say, had been, you know, running a production line doing X. It's like, what effort would it take to move it to Y if Y is a viable thing? So when you look at Dyson started off in vacuum cleaners, but if you step back and make that a generalized statement, it's about moving air around at different flow rates very, very accurately for a function. And so when you start looking at it in those abstract terms, things like that cool fan that had the big ring, the hairdryer makes sense, and all those other things that they've been working on, that comes from being able to abstract what they do very, very well. And to be more tangible about technology, what they do is they make some of the best motors in the world. And if you're just trying to make a leaf blower, they shouldn't be in that market, because the leaf blower, no one wants to pay a lot for a leaf blower. It's pointless. Or at least maybe I'm proven wrong. They'll release one tomorrow. But the point is, with the hairdryer, they were aware that actually men and women are quite happy to pay quite high premiums for beauty. There wasn't a lot of dispute in that market. But when you look at the hairdryer, it's something that hadn't had a lot of innovation grace it for at least sort of 20, 30 years. And so actually it was ripe for disruption, to use that phrase,
right,
by saying we do airflow better than almost anyone else out there. And we also understand a little bit about heating elements, because we've just done a bunch of heaters. We could bring the two things together and then make an experience which is worthy of paying, you know, probably almost 10 times what some people conventionally paid for a hairdryer.
Right.
So I guess I appreciate not everyone's just Dyson and can like bankroll that sort of initiative. But I'd say that, you know, so I'm not wanting to sound glib that you can just flip your production line overnight. But if there's certain things where you say, well, we're really well geared up to do sheet pressing, we do water jet cutting really well, then it would be saying, okay, that industry is stagnant or on pause at the minute. What other things could we use it for to redeploy those skills? Because then it's not about axing jobs and rehiring new talent. It's about using the skill that you already have. And if you say to those people, of course, there's going to be some people who are despairing, and it's very sad when that happens. But if you can resell the future to say, you know, Bob or Sue, I know you were there on the pressings, but we need you to train up for a couple of weeks because we have this great opportunity and there's a huge contract if we can get it right. Let's say you're making car bonnets. And I say this, I've worked in a factory in Newcastle making car bonnets. Mm-hmm. But, you know, if they were saying, actually, the future is now going to be to do with delivery boxes because everyone's, you know, having big parcels sent to their homes, and we're going to be the first to make all these sort of, you know, really nice pressed aluminium things. They're going to be in funky colors, they're going to be on the side of your house, and we've hired a few people to make a special PIN code and it connects with an app, etc., etc. So the point is, how could someone reframe the existing rather than scorched earth, shut down the factory and reinvent it? I think that's going to be, I predict that's where I would see some really exciting survival stories of where people, and to be honest, I've often said this, I don't think I'm saying anything that's crystal ball. I think this happened after the Second World War.
It did,
within living memory.
During, exactly. And after.
People, you know, there were people, there were seamstresses who had been building, you know, parachutes that then went on to sort of, you know, do garments and more fashion when GDP was starting to pick up again. There was women who'd worked in ammunitions who then went, hang on a minute, I am quite technically good. Of course, a lot of them went back to having to do the household and those sorts of drudgery and tasks. But there'll be some, certainly on my grandmother's side, who just refused. And she started up her own little business.
Oh, cool. Cool.
And so I do think it's those people who, you know, realize that they've got to keep moving forward.
Yeah.
Long answer, sorry.
No, it's a cool topic, because it's very interesting, because my grandfather, he used to run a flush metal company, Flushing, New York, with my dad, right? And at that point in time, he switched production during the Second World War to manufacture items. But they actually made some of the first boxes for IBM computers from stainless steel boxes, which is quite interesting. And he was awarded.
And it doesn't sound glamorous, right? It doesn't.
No, it wasn't
time,
glamorous, but it was just necessary. Like,
oh, there's a contract for some boxes. Get it done.
It was necessary.
Right? It's only now that when you tell the story, you're like, ooh, IBM. Yeah. That was very clever of him. Very prescient.
He started with nothing. Yeah. Like he built a company. I mean, he started off actually collecting scrap metal. Yeah. And then he started manufacturing partition walling, so that's basically what they did, and they were working with loads of top architects throughout the states basically for quite a few decades, you know. But it's like it's about just it's not about opportunity. I think it's about finding the problems and then solving them, right? So let's just have an example. We got a problem at the moment of disinfecting things. Yeah. Okay. So what items, you know, people can decide on trying to manufacture, which aren't going to just die as soon as this gets to the new normal, because we don't quite know what the new normal looks like. That's the biggest risk is that people come along and they say, oh, well, I've got this fantastic idea, and then it's going to cost X for the tooling and then the manufacturing design and then the production. And then they're going to end up saying, oh, well, we just made that and now we've got nothing because it didn't work. It's difficult finding a timeless idea, really, right? Do you think or not?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's definitely something to be said for developing, you know, what is basically fashion. I know you wouldn't call COVID fashion, but it has a similar peak and then a drop away, and it might come back as a revival. We hope not, as we hope that all our countries are managing it correctly. But I guess what it's saying is that if you take something like hand sanitizer, and you know, for anyone listening, this is pre-scripting rambling like the post boxes. but I guess sort of the first observation I would look at, like my training says, look at the pain points as well as the total addressable market. And so even after all this is blown over, if we're still wedded to our hand sanitizers, they're going to have to stop drying out your skin and being kind of smelling hospitally. So is it that actually the cosmetics industry are going to be the innovators here, that they go, not only is this lovely smelling moisturizer beautiful and luxurious, but it also kills germs? You know, like that would be an interesting formulation for me. And you kind of go, that you're winning both. You're having people who are the, and you see this so much in sort of behavioral psychology, people who don't want to overtly look like tin hat wearing paranoid people. But they, you know, if they have just touched a button when crossing the street, they're going,
gross. That's what I do.
I mean, I don't even press the button now. I just look and wait for that.
Wait
extra
for
10
someone
seconds.
Else.
No. Just wait for the gap. And actually, I'd say depressingly, there is people who press it, and you just sort of go, and you see them then just suddenly like itch their nose and do this.
Oh.
And you sort of think, oh, despair that. But again, I think that's the thing. It's just one of those things. So much of marketing is often about picking up on the things that are unspoken.
Yeah.
I don't know whether you're much of a fan of Adam Curtis, Century of the Self documentary.
No clue.
Which was like almost 4 hours exploring the work of Edward Bernays, who's Freud's nephew. And very long story short, basically saying there's great things like, did you know, for example, bacon and eggs, that isn't a staple of the British diet. That was basically a fabrication by his company with the Danish pork producers because they wanted to shift more bacon. And that, you know, traditionally bacon was quite chunky. Mm-hmm. And actually the thin rashers, that was a marketing construct.
Yeah.
And I mean, the same with, you know, all the sort of suffragettes movement. He exploited that to get more women into smoking, because until then, women thought it was a dirty, disgusting thing. But by reframing it as being torches of independence and liberation, and also like sticking it to the man that men traditionally smoked big fat cigars, but these were elegant, sophisticated, and you had all the little accoutrements that came with it. He basically condemned, you know, the other half of the population to cancer as well.
Wow.
So therein, I feel, is everything you need to know, is that, I feel this whenever I'm working with students, is that the hard thing isn't often selling the product. The hard thing is doing it and thinking, excuse me, when I tell my grandchildren what I did, are they going to look at me in disgust? You know, because it's... everyone does things in their generation which seem socially acceptable, and then in hindsight seem like an abomination sometimes, or indeed they seem like a great idea. And so how do you know early on? And I guess to come full circle, it's how do we not just innovate to get ourselves out of, you know, dodge with all this madness, but actually do something that we think, actually, this was better than when we started this. We came out the other side even stronger, smarter, with more responsibility to each other and our environment.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. I mean, now if you've got a cold and you go out on a train, right? Like you might get lynched, yeah, or like you get filthy looks.
Oh,
wouldn't you? I mean, but that should have happened in the first place, yeah. You know, like that stuff should have happened, right? But can you drop a link to me so I can drop a link into the show notes for all of that you just talked about?
Yes.
Yeah, Century of the Self. Yeah. Okay. Cool. Well, I'll drop that in there. But that's super interesting. So what other things have you got to share before we scoot off? Because I know you've got another meeting to go to.
Yeah, sure. And I guess we should sort of keep it tight. Gosh. I guess one of the things I find quite an interesting story, just if we keep it on sort of innovation, was another good book to read is Bad Blood, Elizabeth Holmes, which I think everyone in Silicon Valley knows, but actually Europe is a bit further behind. but she basically created, don't quote me on this, but I think a $6 billion industry that was all smoke and mirrors, all nonsense, about basically taking a blood sample and doing all these clever analytics, if I could say
mm-hmm.
it.
Yeah.
And it was all lies. But I kind of feel it's kind of, this isn't to justify bad behavior, but for me, there was almost a bit of like, right, the playing field is starting to level. You are getting women who are just as powerful, just as duplicitous, and just as, you know, game-changingly audacious as their male counterparts. Now, of course, it's unfortunate that it's a really lousy endpoint that she's crooked. And my point isn't trying to obviously condone that. It's to say that it's interesting to see what things are leveling out. And conversely, I say this as a sort of new dad with a 4-year-old, what things I see where masculinity is being shifted towards much more paternal fulfillment. You know, I definitely have spent a lot of time with absolute rock star designers, engineers, whatever, who are still really, really happy to just be like, yep, sorry, I got to put kiddo to bed now. And I actually love that that's not seen as, you know, it's not like Don Draper and Mad Men, where you'd be looked at for being all sorts of things if you'd done that. So I find these two things, these shifts, as much as that feels like it's got nothing to do with pandemics, I kind of feel that's actually influencing a lot of my design, is the sort of soft shifts as well as the big panics. Because I feel if you can combine the two, you have something which isn't just, you know, worthy of attention in terms of PR and hype and noise, but actually in its core has something a lot more genuine and sustainable. So it might be that you ride the wave of post-pandemic innovation, but the reason people stick with your product into the future is because it actually spoke to something quite genuine. So I guess that for me is the sort of duality of two different, seemingly very different things I like to try and weave into the mix, I guess.
Wow. You just blow my mind. This is a brilliant conversation we just had. I can't thank you enough. I've got so many more things that I wanted to like talk about, right? Like literally, I think we should talk about it in on another episode in a few weeks' time, right? Because like I know someone that runs he runs a company called American Air and Water, and they're basically doing some sort of UV light sanitization items, which I find super interesting. So like if you combine what they're doing, yeah, with some sort of disinfectant spray, yeah, for hotel rooms, for example, yeah, you could kill all germs and bacteria. Yeah. Think about like that just blows my mind.
You know, at Dyson, that was the first joint project I did with one other designer was basically me and another guy called Joe developed the humidifier, and that is UV sterilization. And we had to figure out how it didn't breed Legionnaire's disease inside the water tanks. And it had all sorts of like crazy new technology that was a first for the company. And of course, for anyone who, I mean, in America, humidifiers sell, right? But actually in the UK, it's a very non-British product. No one buys humidifiers because it's damp and wet anyway. So yeah. It's one of those interesting products where actually it was bigger in Japan and Canada and America, places like this. And so, yeah, I feel it's funny, the amount of stuff that I never do it by design, but I find myself often getting a brief and going, oh, yeah, I did something on that 5 years ago. And I feel that sort of the, should we say, the long game of my folio has been working on deliberately weird stuff.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But that I think satisfies a need. So I guess maybe that's a good closing point, that you often hear this with architects, that they divide a third of their practice into dead cert big contracts. A third of their stuff, you know, is kind of boring and mundane. And then a third of it is sort of really, if they get it, it's transformative and revolutionary. And I kind of feel that's always been a little bit my folio of just going, I don't know why I'm doing this, but it's really interesting, you know, and I'll keep an eye on this space.
So, super, super. Well, thanks a lot, buddy.
Yeah, it's a pleasure.
Thanks for listening. Please make sure you share this episode with your friends and business connections too. And don't forget to drop us a review wherever you listen. Thank you.